This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Thank you so much for listening. This is Joel Hilliker. Can you tell the difference between a real threat versus a fake threat? I think most people can agree there are a lot of crises in the world today, a lot of threats to the world as we know it. What's interesting, though, is how much disparity there is in identifying exactly what those threats are. I want to talk about the difference between real threats and fake threats and help you to discern the difference. And right in line with that, we'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Richard Palmer about debt in America. This nation has unprecedented wealth. You could say we won the lottery in terms of advantages and resources as a nation. Yet it's still not enough to sustain the standard of living we've come to expect. Richard will talk about that. We'll also hear a report from Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about the fulfillment of one of the most dramatic and specific prophecies our editor-in-chief has focused on in the past 2.5 decades. It relates to what is happening right now in Iraq, as this nation that the U.S. has poured massive resources into over the past 16 years has slipped from American influence and almost entirely into the hands of Iran. We'll begin, though, by talking about threats.
At least 9 people are dead and 16.
This past weekend, we had 2 horrific mass shootings in America, El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio. These get a lot of coverage. They evoke very strong responses from the media, from politicians. They create a lot of buzz on social media and in the public. Whenever something like this happens, people search for answers, and we enter discussion about what do we do about this. There are a lot of calls to do something. Well, the most predictable something is a call for increased gun control laws. And in the last couple of years, especially after these incidents, there's been an additional predictable response, that is to blame the president. And in this case, the media also turned it into blaming white nationalism because the El Paso shooter was anti-immigration. Former President Barack Obama tweeted this about the shootings in El Paso and Dayton. Until all of us stand up and insist on holding public officials accountable for changing our gun laws, these tragedies will keep happening. He talked about this dangerous trend, troubled individuals who embrace racist ideologies and see themselves obligated to act violently to preserve white supremacy. He talked about people who have been, quote, radicalized by white nationalist websites. He also said this is President Obama, all of us have to send a clarion call and behave with the values of tolerance and diversity that should be the hallmark of our democracy. We should soundly reject language coming out of the mouths of any of our leaders that feeds a climate of fear and hatred and normalizes racist sentiments. Leaders who demonize those who don't look like us or suggest that other people, including immigrants, threaten our way of life. So he's clearly talking about the current president. A lot of people have said repeatedly that the current president is fomenting these kinds of white supremacist ideas in the country. President Obama also says that that language has been at the root of slavery and Jim Crow, the Holocaust, the genocide in Rwanda, and ethnic cleansing in the Balkans. So this man has identified what he believes are the real threats here: guns, white nationalism, racism, the type of racism that leads to the Holocaust and genocide and ethnic cleansing, and that's being encouraged by our current president. Now, it wasn't just former President Obama talking like this. It was all the Democratic presidential candidates. It was all the major media outlets. The New York Times headline was El Paso shooting suspect's manifesto echoes Trump's language. The Washington Post criticized the president for, quote, us against them language about immigrants, and for his lack of, quote, a forceful repudiation of the white nationalism taking rise under his watch. So now white nationalism. is the big threat in America today. This is what you're hearing on the cable news networks of the last few days. Axios wrote this on Monday. Tech companies say they're ready to fight white nationalist terror. It says tech companies are willing to work more closely with law enforcement to fight white nationalist terrorism, but the industry is skeptical of the White House's seriousness on the issue. So they're basically saying we could resolve this problem. We could end gun violence and hate if only the White House were more serious about this threat. Now, this is a terrific example of a fake threat. First of all, the idea that the problem here is you have a Trump-loving white nationalist committing violence is clearly false. Stephen Fleury did an excellent job on his program on Monday pointing out just how many facts you have to ignore to come away with that narrative from what happened. According to the El Paso shooter's own manifesto, he was against immigrants not because of racism, but because he says they're going to jeopardize free universal health care, universal basic income, and other ambitious social projects. Those are his words. He said, we have too many people in this country and they're using up too many natural resources. They're harming the earth. So we need to eliminate some people. So he's like a eco-terrorist. And he actually wrote this in his manifesto. My opinions on automation. He's saying that because there are more and more jobs being automated, then we're going to have to institute a universal basic income. And so the more people there are, then the less likely that is to happen. But he says, my opinions on automation, immigration, and the rest predate Trump and his campaign for president. This is exactly what he wrote. I'm putting this here because some people will blame the president or certain presidential candidates for this attack. This is not the case. I know that the media will probably call me a white supremacist anyway and blame Trump's rhetoric. The media is infamous for fake news. Their reaction to this attack will likely just confirm that. Now, this man was crazy, but he was clearly exactly right about that. That's exactly what the media did. The media actually somehow managed to turn this pro-big government, socialist, eco-terrorist into a white nationalist. And they turned what he did into a warning about the threat of white supremacy in America. Now, it takes some serious logical contortions to do that. And to be honest, it takes a lot of deceit. It takes a lot of embracing and publicizing lies. But this type of thing happens all the time, more and more in society today. Just to get a little perspective on this, how serious of a threat are mass shootings in America? These are some stats from 538. It says there are 33,000 gun deaths in America each year. That number's been going up the last few years. In 2016, it was nearly 39,000. Between 1989 and 2014, mass shootings accounted for 0.13% of the gun deaths in America. Not 13% or 1.3%, 0.13%. And also quite small, contributing to that number, were terrorism and police officers killed in the line of duty and police shootings of civilians. These barely register at all in the number of gun deaths. Two-thirds of gun deaths in America are suicides. And the other third of gun deaths are homicides. And an outsized percentage of those are black men killing other black men. Stephen Fleury brought this out, that the very weekend of these two shootings, this past weekend, seven people were killed in shootings just in Chicago. 44 more were injured in shootings in one city in America. This goes on all the time. And the numbers of homicides and the numbers of suicides dwarf the mass shootings that get all the attention. That really is a crisis. There is a suicide crisis in America. There's an inner city violence crisis that dwarfs the problem of mass shootings. Every year, some 22,000 people in America kill themselves with guns. And the press reports that worldwide, Worldwide, in the past 8 years, 175 people have been killed in attacks motivated, at least partially, by white nationalism. And I think that number, you could question that number if they're going to include incidents like what happened in El Paso. I imagine that by some counts, they do. But that's less than 1/1,000th of the death count of suicide in America, and it's a global statistic. The press is so eager to go after the white nationalists in a way that it is totally unwilling to go after just about any other problem that exists. You turn on the news and you'd think that white nationalism is the biggest threat to America right now. But I will just state this as a fact. White nationalism is a fake threat. I'm not saying that it's not a problem. There are white nationalists and racists in America, and some of them are violent. But it's not even close to being a major problem in America, certainly not compared to many, many other real threats. It seems like everyone agrees there are serious crises and threats facing America today, but there is wild disparity over identifying just what those threats are. Now, the Trump administration says, with a lot of evidence to back it up, that illegal immigration is a real threat to America. There are a lot of officials at the border who agree with that, that people are flooding into this country illegally, and that poses security risks. That introduces criminals and terrorists into the country. And there are a lot of articles about this all the time. That even terrorist groups are introducing, they're sending people across the border into the United States. And all of that illegal immigration, it puts strains on the national economy, on state economies. And that's not to say anything about just what happens culturally to a country when immigration is unchecked, especially in a country where many of these people end up becoming voters. And that can decide elections. Nobody would dispute that, that that actually can have a significant impact on the country. Now, those are real. But the most common problem focused on when it comes to immigration is racism. Anybody who actually wants to enforce the law and protect the borders is supposedly doing so because they're white nationalists. To even suggest that there may be cause of concern when you have foreigners entering the country illegally, that this might hurt America in any way, means that you're a racist, you're a white supremacist. Again, I'm not saying America doesn't have white nationalists, but the actual threat they pose is barely a blip on the radar compared to the threat of open borders. The left is screaming hysterically about racism and the danger of another Holocaust. And so they say the solution is we need to eliminate the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, eliminate ICE, erase America's borders. You may have a termite problem in your house, but if your house is on fire, you deal with the fire. You don't turn your back on the fire and start ripping out the drywall to deal with the termites. But what's happening in America, in many cases, people are actually trying to solve the termite problem by setting the house on fire. Or they see a cockroach and they say, we need to burn the house to the ground. That's essentially what's happening because of an inability to distinguish real threats from fake threats. Let's take another example. We're hearing a lot these days about the problem of economic inequality, unfair distribution of wealth. For example, here's Democratic presidential candidate Bill de Blasio speaking earlier this year.
So I say there's plenty of money in this world and there's plenty of money in this country, but it's in the wrong hands. And we have to have policies that give people a chance again by redistributing some of that money back to working people.
The problem is the money's in the wrong hands. Well, of course, that begs the question, who put it there? How did it get there? But he says the solution is we need policies that redistribute that money. We need to let the government decide how to redistribute that money fairly. Plenty of money, we just need to put it in the right hands. So you have, solutions like the wealth tax, taking more money from the richest people and giving it to the rest of the people. Again, let's get some perspective. America is $22 trillion in debt, and the debt is rising rapidly. We're going to hear more about that from Richard Palmer later in the program today. $22 trillion in debt. That is a real crisis. At some point, interest on the debt is going to be our biggest expense. If interest rates rise, then we're done for. We can't even pay on that debt. But the discussion taking place in America today, it's not about how to pay that off. It's not about bringing spending under control. It's not about saving up while, you know, we're in relatively healthy times economically or good times. The discussion is about free health care, free college, reparations for slavery. That's the discussions that we're having now. This is the most prosperous country in history, with more economic opportunity for more people than any nation in history. And yet the supposed crisis is that the wealth is unfairly distributed. That is a fake crisis. It completely misdiagnoses the problem, and it's going to make the real crisis many times worse. But we hear so much about that, that we're convinced of this very distorted picture, and we think that that's reality. In terms of a global threat, people think the number one existential threat is climate change. Again, pollution is definitely a problem, and it needs to be addressed. We've done a lot of good to address that problem. It's not as bad as it once was. But the question comes down to how serious the threat is relative to other threats. The reality is there are several challenges to America's power and its way of life developing, and climate change does not register a blip on that radar. Americans are oblivious to what's happening in the rest of the world. We try to keep you abreast of those things on this program and at the Trumpet as much as we can. I saw something from the Council on Foreign Relations. Its president, Richard Haass, wrote a book called A World in Disarray, and he tweeted this on Monday. U.S.-China trade war, hottest July ever, Hong Kong on the edge, odds of U.S.-Iran-Turkish-Kurdish conflicts mounting, new India-Pakistan-Kashmir crisis, Japan-South Korea diplo-echo confrontation, looming Brexit, the word disarray too restrained to capture the world's deterioration. Now, all these crises that he's talking about, they're not going away. They threaten to have serious destabilizing effects on the world order. But who in America is really focusing on those things? Axios referred to that tweet and a letter from Ian Bremmer, who's the president of the Eurasia Group, with a list of what he called geopolitical fat tail risks. And he listed Cold War II. Tensions between the U.S. and China have hit a tipping point with the risk of destabilizing global technology supply chains. He talks about the U.S.-Iran conflict, the U.S.-Russia cyber war, Italy fiscal crisis, Turkey, China versus Hong Kong, Trump versus Taiwan, Brexit. He said the likelihood of every one of these is likely to increase over coming months. If in a normal geopolitical environment, these would be individually 1 to 5% scenarios, over the coming year, they're more like 10 to 30%. In other words, we should expect at least one or two to actually happen. And that's not priced into the markets right now. These things could have serious effects on the American and global markets. And what happens then? What happens if we enter into another recession? Jeb Bush tweeted this, apart from the two tragic mass murders, that's where everyone's attention is focused, this weekend saw China's devaluation of the yuan and suspension of U.S. ag exports into the country, Japan and South Korea in a full-fledged diplomatic fight started over Japan's occupation of Korea 80 years ago, the escalation of the crisis in Hong Kong, India scrapping the special autonomous status in parts of Kashmir, Turkey amassing tens of thousands of troops along the Syrian border to attack the Kurds. Moscow police arresting 600 people for participating in a, quote, unsanctioned rally. No progress on Brexit, and Iran interdicting an Iraqi fuel vessel. And to think Many now believe that America's leadership in the world is not necessary. You know, you listen to the Democratic debates, and the only thing that they say with respect to foreign policy is, well, we need to get out of Afghanistan. We need to bring our troops home. We need to redirect these resources from what's happening elsewhere in the world back home. That's essentially the extent of what they say on the foreign policy front. These are real threats. These are actual threats. And America's wrapped up in fighting fake threats. We're inventing threats that distract us from actual threats. We're trying to secure the rights of transgender people. We're crusading to protect the world from the tyranny of misgendering someone. It's remarkable how much error is being accepted into mainstream thinking today. If you hear a lie often enough, eventually you come to believe it. And more ideas and notions that are egregiously wrong are coming to be accepted as factual. And no amount of proof to the contrary makes any difference. It's like just a steamroller of error that is crushing the truth. If you view everything with the right perspective, you can recognize truth. But when you view everything through a distorted lens, you can be looking directly at the truth and see evil. Like the people who were looking directly at the Son of God and they saw a glutton and a wine bibber. People are looking at the truth, they're criticizing the truth, and they're wallowing in error and falsehood like a pig in a mud hole. 2 Thessalonians 2, 9 through 11 is an end time prophecy about the church of God. And it says that a man would come after the working of Satan with all power and signs and lying wonders. He's just doing a work that is fraudulent in every way. And it says, with all deceivable of unrighteousness in them that are perishing because they received not the love of the truth. The people didn't love the truth, and it made them very susceptible to deception. And it says, for this cause God shall send them strong delusion that they should believe a lie. More and more people are believing lies today. What's happening in America today and in other nations, it's a secular version of that prophecy in 2 Thessalonians 2. It's happening on an increasingly massive scale. God tells us, prove all things, hold fast that which is good. That's the only way to avoid deception. It's critical that you know how to distinguish real threats from fake threats. It's not the easiest thing to do, but I can give you a formula that is a huge help. It's a formula we use at The Trumpet to determine the actual threat level on any given subject. Look at what Bible prophecy says. It'll help you distinguish the actual crises from the red herrings. Go to thetrumpet.com. Look at our trends tab, and it shows four main prophetic blocks discussed in prophecy, and it gives several trends for each of those areas. These are real threats. There's no fake news there. We also have an article called, But What Do I Watch For? You can look at it. You can find the link to it in the show notes for this program today, but it gives the overview of Bible prophecy. And it'll help you keep your perspective. It'll help you stay clear from being deceived and sucked into fighting fake threats. And it'll keep you grounded in the truth.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
America is fabulously wealthy and prosperous, more than any nation in history. Why, then, is it going deeper and deeper into debt? We'll get a good look at this problem in this report from Richard Palmer.
Alex and Rhoda Toth were struggling financially. With six kids and little income, it was hard for them to get by. And then in 1990, they hit the jackpot. Literally, the Toths won $13 million in the lottery. And that is where you'd think the story would end, and they all lived happily ever after. But if that were the case, this would be a really short report, and it didn't. The money changed their life, yes, but only for a few years. Then it ran out. The Toths filed for bankruptcy twice. The family ended up back in poverty. The IRS accused them of fiddling their taxes to try and keep that millionaire's lifestyle going just a little bit longer. But by the time Alex Toth died in 2008, they didn't even have mains electricity at home. After Alex's death, Rhoda pleaded guilty to tax evasion and was sentenced to 2 years in jail and fined $1.1 million. But perhaps the most surprising part about the Toths' story is that they were not alone. Around one-third of lottery winners end up going bankrupt. They often follow a similar pattern. Suddenly, flush with more cash than they could have ever imagined themselves owning, they spend on anything. A luxury holiday? Sure, we've just won the lottery. A new house? Well, of course, we've just won the lottery. Friends in need? Well, we've just won the lottery. We have to help out. The CEO of Wealth Financial Group, Steve Lewitt, said people who were little, ordinary people all of a sudden become extraordinary. Talking about what happens when someone wins the lottery. They're euphoric. They lose all sense of reality. They think they're invincible and powerful. They think they're Superman. No purchase seems out of reach. Expensive vices like drugs or gambling suddenly becomes affordable. And some succumb to those temptations. And then if they're in a bit of a financial squeeze, well, it's easy for them to borrow money. After all, they won the lottery. Everyone assumes they'll be able to pay it back. But eventually, the superpowers run out. The money's gone, creditors come calling, and the winner is left worse off than when they started. But this doesn't just describe an indebted lottery winner. This describes the United States. Tim Marshall, in his book Prisoners of Geography, began his chapter on the United States by writing, "If you won the lottery and were looking to buy a country to live in, the first one the estate agent would show you would be the United States of America. And this is a country that's got more navigable waterways than the rest of the world combined. The planet's largest contiguous area of farmland. It's got vast amounts of natural resources of all kinds." Now, many lottery winners receive their winnings in the form of annual income, rather than one lump sum. America's quote-unquote prize has also generated masses of wealth year after year. But just as with these lottery winners, that wealth can't fund everything. But that hasn't stopped America from trying. The world's largest military? Well, we need to be safe. Medicare? We need healthcare for the poor. Banks in trouble? We have to help. And there are arguments to justify just about everything America spends money on. But the point is, America spends with no reference to affordability. Now, quote-unquote successful lottery winners, the ones that don't go bust, they save or invest some of their money for the future. Joseph, from the Book of Genesis, the world's earliest recorded economic planner, saved when times are good to spend when times are bad. Well, in modern times, this theory has been adjusted slightly to borrow when times are bad and pay it back when times are good. But right now, America has the lowest unemployment rate since 1969. And at the same time, it is borrowing more than $1 trillion a year. The nation is borrowing spectacularly when times are good. And then when times are bad, what then? Last Friday, President Donald Trump signed a new budget deal. It suspends the debt ceiling until March 2021 and borrows money left, right, and center. In 2017, the year Mr. Trump came into office, the U.S. borrowed about $500 billion. The next year, that more than doubled to $1.34 trillion. And then this year, borrowing is forecast to be down only slightly to $1.23 trillion. The president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget said this could be the worst budget agreement in our nation's history, calling it a total abdication of fiscal responsibility by Congress and the president. The last time America was this indebted compared to the size of its economy was 1947, when the nation was paying off the massive borrowing required to finance the defeat of the Nazis. But in 2019, the US is not fighting Nazis. It's simply adding to the debt just to meet its day-to-day budget. And that's not sustainable. And just like desperate lottery winners, the US has resorted to creative financial practices to keep the party going. After the 2008 financial crisis, the Federal Reserve began creating money from nothing and lending it to the government and banks in quantitative easing. The Fed insisted that it would wind down this easing at a later date, that it would get all the money it loaned out back and turn it back into nothing. But more than 10 years on, this is happening only very slowly. Now, the lottery winners that go bankrupt, they go from riches to rags fast. They'll spend some time living the high life, but then bills start to catch up with them. All of a sudden, the full extent of their debts are revealed and they're off to bankruptcy court. And the same is set to happen to the United States. At the moment, the nation is still in the luxury holidays and fast cars phase, even though all of that spending is fueled by debt. But at some point, probably when the next downturn hits, everyone will realize that the US can't pay. We're watching the Tothsis story play out at a national level. We're just waiting to see how it ends. Except there is a source that tells us that, and it also explains how and why America received that fantastic lottery win in the first place. America's windfall was no lucky bet. In the book of Genesis, God promised Abraham that he would be a father of many nations. And in repeating these promises to Abraham's descendants, God promised them the fat places of the earth and plenty of corn and wine. The descendants of Abraham would spread abroad, he said, all over the earth. Now, these prophecies couldn't possibly apply to the Jews alone. That's just one nation, and there's one nation of Israel in the Middle East, not nations plural. And the Jews have never been blessed with the prosperity and national power on the scale of these promises to Abraham and the patriarchs. But these promises, and many more, do describe America's massive prosperity. They match that very well. And as our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, proves, America is also a descendant of Abraham, and is one of the many nations promised to him. The windfall came to America because of God's promises to Abraham. But the Bible warns that America must obey God to keep this windfall, and if not, well, then calamity would strike. The prophet Isaiah, for example, preserved his message in a book for the time to come. He gave more than just a warning to the ancient kingdom of Judah. There's a message for America today in that book. In Isaiah 2, he wrote, "Their land is also full of silver and gold. Neither is there any end of their treasures. Their land is also full of horses. Neither is there any end of their chariots." You know, what an accurate description of America today. The land is so much full of so much wealth and power that many feel secure, just like the lottery winner. Many feel like Superman. The nation can do anything. But Isaiah warns in the next verse, "Their land also is full of idols. They worship the work of their own hands, that which their own fingers have made. And the nation is proud and sinful." Just like many of the bankrupt lottery winners, America lacks the character to hold on to all of that wealth. And the nation suffers the consequences of that lack of character. In the rest of the chapter, Isaiah lists the punishments God will add on top of the inevitable consequences of America's behavior. Well, why these punishments? God wants to correct the nation so that it can handle that kind of massive wealth. God wants to bless the United States as he wants to bless all people. But as we're seeing today, wealth without character only leads to ruin. For America to really benefit from those blessings, it needs God's correction. It needs God to correct the nation's character. And it will take some hard correction at times, but it is all being done by a loving God that wants to make the nation ready for unimaginable blessings. You can learn more about God's plan and purpose in all of this in our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy.
Thanks very much for that, Richard. It's a terrific analogy. America winning the lottery. I just thinking on this, I was thinking there is one difference, and that is that for the longest time in America, we weren't in this kind of spending frenzy that we're in now. How did we get to the point where these these deficits and the debt is going up at the rate that it is now.
Yeah, I think that where the analogy does break down a bit is a nation is led by different people and different political views and political philosophies as it goes over the decades, the centuries. So you do have a more of, say, a change of approach than you probably do have in an individual who might win the lottery and burn it all in a matter of years. So you look at the history of both Britain and America, and every so often you had leaders come along who put a real priority on getting rid of debt, who really did not like the idea of debt, wanted to go back to zero. And you had, I mean, right from the start, you had people say like Andrew Jackson coming up. You had into, say, the 20s, you had people like Harding and Coolidge. In the UK, you could look at the going back to, say, the 18th century, you can look at the careers of both the Pitts, Pitt the Elder and Pitt the Younger, that really set a standard that the British Empire tried to follow for a long time afterwards of borrowing when it came to national emergencies, when it came to crisis, like, say, Napoleon taking over the world. But then as soon as the crisis was over, putting a real priority on paying that debt back and even, you know, really making some sacrifices to try and get that debt paid back. You know, we've not had that kind of thinking for years and years now. I mean, instead, it's only been the borrowing, and there's just this idea of there being consequences for debt, or this approach that we need to get rid of it. Nobody seems to have had that for a long, long time.
Yeah. Yeah, you didn't hear the first segment on the program today, but I was just talking about the political discussions in America right now centering around free health care and free college and reparations and global warming initiatives, green energy, all of these things that are going to cost a whole lot of money, as if we can afford these things. But it seems like America is on a train that it can't get off of. And more and more people are jumping on, and we're just barreling toward economic ruin. How do we jump off of that?
Yeah, it's exactly like the analogy with the lottery winners. You feel like Superman. Like you can pay for anything. We've got unlimited money, it is a very hard, I mean, in terms of trying to get control of this problem and roll it back, it's very hard. I mean, some of it is a case of kind of trying to shut stable doors after the horse is already bolted.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look, for example, at when it comes to things like pensions and Social Security, the government came out and basically made a promise to people. They said, okay, well, we're going to require you to give us some of your money. We'll keep that. We'll look after it for you, and we'll pay it back to you when you retire in the form of Social Security payments and pensions. Then the government went and broke that promise and spent all of that money in the Social Security pension part. Now we're getting to this point there, because they've done that, that's one of the many commitments that the nation just can't afford. And, you know, where do we go from here? I mean, does the government turn around and say to pensioners, sorry, we promised you that we'd save this money, but we didn't, you have no pension?
Right.
I mean, that's...
No government's willing to do that. But I guess you arrive at the point where it just can't pay, and it's no longer a question of breaking a promise like willingly. It's just that it can't. They simply go bust.
Right. And I think, though, more fundamentally, like I was talking about towards the end of the report, it's a character issue. You know, America lacked the character to look after this wealth, to plan for the future. And you get almost this vicious cycle, I think, going where... You see, you know, the government will step in and start to use all of this money to do things that the family used to do, to take care of aging parents, to take care of sick members of the family, sick people that the family used to step in and take care of, funds for children, funds for education, funds for keeping kids out of trouble. You have masses of money required by single parenting. You have the breakdown of the family, meaning you have huge prison populations, which require massive amounts of policing, massive amounts of funds going to prisons, the justice system. And it all wraps into a whole load of moral problems. And that's something that you don't see, I don't think, explored enough in the media. You get the kind of libertarians that will just talk about economic problems in isolation.
Mm.
But how you ratchet that back is really hard. I mean, yeah, the government's started taking care of burdens that families used to take care of. People have rearranged their entire lives based on those assumptions. If the government steps away, if the government pulls out of many of these initiatives and says, okay, well, we're going to stop paying for the medical care of elderly people, families aren't going to suddenly instantly rush in and fill that void. So it's a really, once you start going down that route, I think it's a really hard process to reverse. And it's because you're encouraging a lack of character. And so trying to rebuild the character that you need to go back to a more sustainable society isn't easy.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Looking at the moral dimension of the question on several levels really does illuminate a lot of the core causes for what we're looking at here. And really, the analogy that you're using about the lottery winner speaks to that character aspect of the story. Thanks so much for that, Richard. We've been talking to trumpet writer Richard Palmer about America's debt, and he wrote a trumpet brief about this yesterday, and you can find it. It's posted on thetrumpet.com, the title From Windfall to Wipeout. Thanks so much, Richard.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour.
The trumpet often speaks of a biblically prophesied king of the South. And our editor-in-chief has said for over 2.5 decades that this prophecy will be fulfilled by Iran, and that a key part of its power will be its conquest of Iraq. Well, we've seen this prophecy fulfilled before our eyes, as we will now hear in this report from Brent Noctegal.
America is celebrating after helping to drive the Islamic State out of Iraq and Syria, but it should not be celebrating. The reality of the situation is being dismissed. The United States has just suffered its greatest defeat ever in the Middle East. As shocking as that statement may sound, I can prove it to you. That's how Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flory began his feature article in the January 2018 Trumpet magazine. The article was entitled, America's Greatest Defeat, Iran's Victory. What's stunning about this claim is that Mr. Flory related America's greatest defeat not in terms of the Iraq War or even in terms of the Iran nuclear deal, but rather in terms of Iran's growing power in Iraq. The events of the past month show that Iran has conquered Iraq and that the United States has little to no ability to push back against it. As a point of reference, it's important to recall recent history in Iraq.
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
In 2003, the United States led a coalition of nations to remove Iraqi strongman Saddam Hussein from power. However, after removing Saddam, the United States was faced with what to do next. This meant revolutionizing Iraq's government into representative democracy, and hopefully giving all of Iraq's different sects a voice in running the country. All the while, Iran, the behemoth of 80 million people next door and longtime enemy of Saddam's Iraq, subverted the process by using Iraqi Shiites to fight a proxy war against the United States forces. While there was no outward fighting between Iran and the United States forces, by the middle of 2006, it was known that Iran was sending weapons to Iraqi Shiite militias to fight against the United States forces. We know that this support amounted to over 600 deaths of American servicemen. Nevertheless, under the leadership of General Petraeus, the United States dramatically increased the troop numbers in Iraq and stabilized the country. However, things changed with the election of Barack Obama. The troop surge was halted, and eventually the United States forces would be removed hastily from Iraq. The vacuum created by the United States forces was filled not by the Iraqi government forces, but rather by Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which gradually morphed into the Islamic State. This barbaric fighting force grew in power until it, too, was knocking on the gates of the Iraqi capital of Baghdad. A series of battles against the Iraqi military had shown the Islamic State to be more powerful than the state military of Iraq. Help was needed. That help came in the form of the United States air power, beating back the caliphate in the skies, and the mobilization of militias to fight on the ground. However, most of these militias were not under the state control of Iraq, but rather they answered to Iran. These were not some ragtag bunch of unsophisticated fighters. Rather, they were a combined militia of 100,000 highly equipped, highly trained ground forces. And if you can believe it, the United States was actually in league with these Iranian-backed fighters. And it was largely this tandem of ground and air forces that beat back the Islamic State from southern Iraq. Eventually, the United States claimed victory over the Islamic State. Yes, victory over the Islamic State. But at what cost? And this is the context for Mr. Flurry's January 2018 piece, America's Greatest Defeat, Iran's Victory. While the United States touted victory, Mr. Flurry wrote that it was actually America's greatest defeat. He wrote this in the article. In fact, by directing its firepower against the Islamic State, the US vastly expanded the power of Iran. When you see what Iran is doing, it's dumbfounding that the United States has followed an anti-terrorism strategy that involves fighting alongside Iran, the number one state sponsor of terrorism. For America to be fighting alongside Iran, something is terribly wrong. We have fallen into a deadly trap. Turning Iran into an ally in our battle against the Islamic State has not only eliminated this organization that has been competing against Iran among the radicals, it's also legitimized Iran in the eyes of the rest of the world. America is not actually fighting alongside of Iran. We are empowering it. End quote. As of 2019, we are getting a clear picture of just how empowered Iran has become in Iraq. Just as the Islamic State filled a vacuum created after the United States forces left Iraq, these Shiite militias, or Iran's proxy forces, are filling the vacuum created by the Islamic State. In effect, the United States forces have paved the way for the Iranian takeover of Iraq. As of August 2019, this Iranian takeover is obvious for everyone to see. In many, many ways, it was naive to think that the Shiite militias would come together and put their lives on the line to fight against the Islamic State and then agree to disband when the fight against the Islamic State was over. This is not for a lack of trying on behalf of the Baghdadi government, though. The current Iraqi Prime Minister and the previous one have both issued decrees for the militias to lay down their weapons. They have induced the militias to do so by allowing them to form political parties. They have even added militias to parts of the Iraqi security establishment. According to the latest Iraqi budget, these militias actually receive $2 billion per year. That's right. Iraqi militias that answer to Iran are right now being paid $2 billion per year for salaries and expenses. Now, many in Iraq, including the Prime Minister, understands what is happening. They understand that Iraq's sovereignty is quickly eroding, and that's why he gave the militias till July 31st to disband their forces. But that date came and went over a week ago, with the militias agreeing that they will disband, but just on their timetable. This is what John Hanna, a former national security advisor for Dick Cheney, wrote on For Foreign Policy on July 31st, the date that the militias were meant to disband. Quote, Iran's proxies may go through the motions of taking on additional symbols of the state, designations, uniforms, facilities, but will jealously maintain their autonomy as independent military, political, and economic actors outside of state control. They'll gladly accept the political and legal cover of being an integral part of the state and the greater access to state assets that comes with it, while rejecting any true accountability to the Iraqi government. Later, he wrote this. U.S. officials are facing an unpleasant reality. The facts are quite stark when laid out. The United States considers the Iraqi government to be an important security partner, providing its military with billions of dollars of support and advanced equipment. But that same partner has welcomed a group of Iran-backed militias, all sworn enemies of the United States, some designated terrorist groups, and most with American blood on their hands, into the Iraqi security forces as a largely independent, parallel army. The Iraqi government now generously funds those groups through the national budget. End quote. Now, some think that Iraq can still be saved from Iran's grasp, but don't bet on it. Israel certainly isn't. Twice in July, Israeli jets struck at Iranian targets deep inside Iraq. This was the first Israeli strike in Iraq in almost 40 years. The targets were weapon transfers facilities operated by the Badr organization, one of these Shiite militias, and a political force that answers to Iran rather than the Iraqi government. These strikes killed over 40 people. Many of them were Iranians, but most were Iraqis, again, that answer to Iran. The attack was a message from Israel to Baghdad. If you don't have the power to stop Iran from using Iraq as a base to prepare to launch missiles to Israel, we will strike. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said as much in his speech to the UN General Assembly last year. He said this.
And Israel will do whatever it must do to defend itself against Iran's aggression. We will continue to act against you in Syria. We will act against you in Lebanon. We will act against you in Iraq. We will act against you whenever and wherever. We must act to defend our state and to defend our people.
The Israeli strikes reveal a stunning new reality in the Middle East. Iraq has fallen to Iran, and the government in Baghdad has no power to stop it. Really, the United States at this point doesn't have the will to stop it as well. In his piece, Mr. Flory wrote, "How can America or any other power effectively push back? It'll take some determined violence on the ground, and America is proving unwilling to make such a commitment. This is just something the United States will not have the stomach to do." But it gets worse. Iran's takeover of Iraq actually threatens to undermine the entire United States high-pressure campaign on Iran. The United States, of course, is placing strict financial sanctions on Iran to cut off its money that it needs to fund its terrorist activities. All the while, though, Iran's proxies inside Iraq are being funded not by Iran, but by the Iraqi state budget. What is the United States to do? Sanction one part of the official Iraqi military and then give money, weapons, and aid to the other part of the state military? The new reality in Iraq is this. You have a parallel fighting force operating inside of Iraq that answers to Iran. This force is unwilling to come under the governance of the state, and you have this fighting force that is being paid for, in part, by the Iraqi government. And the government is too powerless to stop it. If that sounds familiar, it's exactly what Iran has done already in Lebanon, through its proxy Hezbollah. Decades ago, the Lebanese tolerated the Iranian-backed group Hezbollah to be used in the fight against Israel. It wasn't optimum, but it was necessary. 4 years ago, Iraqis and even the United States tolerated Iranian-backed militias to be used in the fight against the Islamic State. Again, it wasn't optimum, but it was necessary. But even after periods of relative peace between Israel and Lebanon, Hezbollah is yet to lay down its weapons. Instead, Hezbollah now virtually controls Lebanon. Sadly, we are witnessing the same thing play out in Iraq. But Iraq isn't Lebanon. Lebanon has minimal natural resources, a small diverse population, and is very far from Iran. Iraq, on the other hand, is the fourth largest oil producer, a largely Shiite population, and furthermore, it's right next to Iran. Controlling Iraq is much more than just controlling this landmass. It's also controlling the wealth, eventually, the resources, and the population. And depending on how powerful these militias become, it could mean controlling the billions of dollars of military hardware the United States has given to Iraq. In fact, controlling Iraq will empower Iran to a completely new level. In biblical terminology, controlling Iraq will make Iran a king.
Thank you very much for that, Brent. You started by talking about Gerald Flory talking about the Iranian conquest of Iraq. I'd like to just ask you, how valuable is Iraq to Iran? Why is Iran so focused on taking over here, and how much does this conquest enable Iran to fulfill this role that we're talking about, the King of the South?
I think there's really two parts to that question. One is that Iraq has been one of the greatest enemies of Iran for so long. And so if it was the case where you had this large power next to Iran that was continuously fighting against it or maximizing the opportunities it had to grow in power against Iran, that would certainly limit Iran's ability to maintain a lot of control, or at least rise to the biblically prophesied king level that the Bible speaks about this king of the South having. So there's that facet. But then you have to also look at the amount of resources that control of Iraq's territory and its population would give Iran. You've got Iraq being right now, it's actually rivaling Saudi Arabia as being the fourth largest oil producing country. And so that's quite
That's massive. And so you could say if Iran ever conquered Iraq fully and they controlled the oil reserves, that maybe there'd be sanctions put on them. But then you're taking off a lot of oil off the market, which would send prices sky high. The United States just couldn't do that with its sanctions. And so there's the wealth that comes through the oil that Iraq has as well. You've also got to consider the population of Shiites that Iran has, and that Iran would have access to, that would be driven to the cause. This is an extra 100, 150,000 fighters that Iran has, even now, that are operating inside Iraq, that would produce the manpower necessary to be a military power. And then you've also got to add the military armaments that the United States has given to Iraq over the past 10 years. Iraq has been a United States ally for so long, and they have furnished them with an amazing amount of materiel, billions of dollars worth, that is now being is in control of by the Iraqi government and the Iraqi military. But now you also have facets of the Iraqi military that are answering to Iran. So as Iran's power becomes as Iraq is solidified underneath this king of the south of Iran, it gets access to so much more resources to then push, as the Bible talks about. And I would say one more thing. Iran's control over Iraq really does offer Iran a safety valve, or let's say a pressure valve, a pressure release on the United States sanctions. Because even if the United States continues to sanction Iran, Iraq is so connected with Iran that there are a lot of financial deals that are being done right now back to Iran. Iraq buys a lot of electricity off Iran. And so Iran gets finances through Iraq. And so for the United States to hit Iran really hard, it would also have to sanction Iraq eventually. But it simply will not do that.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating stuff, Brent. It's a blockbuster story. It's really one of the biggest stories that we've covered in the decades that the trumpet has been around. I really appreciate you putting all of the pieces together in this that really demonstrate that this prophecy that Gerald Fleury has been pointing to from the very beginning was dead on accurate. The evidence really does back up what he was saying back in 92, 93, 94, one of the earliest prophecies that he was focusing on. People accuse us of tooting our own horn when it comes to this type of thing. But the reality is that we're really just showing that prophecy can be relied on when you're looking at the international relations and analyzing what's happening in the world. It shows you just how prescient it is and how helpful it is in giving us that insight. So we do appreciate that very much. We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about Iran taking over Iraq. He's writing an article about this for thetrumpet.com. You can keep your eye on the front page of the website to watch for that. Thanks so much, Brent.
No problem.
I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Richard Palmer and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Alexander Pope. True ease in writing comes from art, not chance, as those move easiest who have learned to dance. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.